Hello and welcome to Dealcast, the voice of Merger Market, the world's leading publication about mergers and acquisitions. I'm Juliana Needham, a journalist who's been covering M&A for a decade. Today, I'm joined by John West, who's Merger Market's global commentary editor and also author of Continental Drift, a weekly column exploring the macroeconomic, political and policy dynamics that are influencing M&A. In John's latest piece, he dives into the recent turmoil in private credit markets, sparked by the collapse of First Brands and Tricolor Holdings, and what it reveals about the deeper cracks in the US consumer economy. We'll explore whether this is a contained credit story or if it's a broader warning sign for dealmakers heading into 2026. Hi, John. Welcome.
Hello.
So, First Brands and Tricolor, is the private credit impact or fallout a systemic risk or is it just noise?
Well, you can understand why people are asking the question, because as with the subprime mortgage securitizations imploding during the credit crunch of 2007-2008, you've got a securitized product based around a debt instrument, which is being spread primarily through CLOs. And so that investor risk seems to be the purpose of spreading it is to spread the risk and quantify it at the lower end. But obviously, people start to fear that actually has spread the risk across many different portfolios. And we've seen, particularly with Jefferies and UBS, that some of the sort of legacy lenders, if you will, have been quite exposed. So you can see why people are asking the question. It seems to have that kind of parallel. But I think it's important to get this into some kind of perspective. I mean, during the global financial crisis, total losses across US financial institutions were estimated at $1.6 trillion. Now, direct lending in the United States is probably only $2 trillion, roughly. So, you would need losses on the scale of sort of 90-odd percent of the book in order to have the kind of losses that we saw in the subprime crisis. So, I'm not really of the view that this is a systemic risk on the scale of the subprime crisis. But what I do think that with both First Brands and Tricolor, you're seeing there are some signs of stress in the corporate landscape across America.
Yeah. And Jefferies, the CEO of Jefferies, was speaking, saying the bank had been defrauded. And obviously with the banks being part of this, it does kind of have echoes of the 2007-2008 financial crisis.
Yes. And I think that, obviously, there are only accusations of fraud at this point across both First Brands and Tricolor, subject of a number of lawsuits. But as I said in my column this week, when that tide goes out economically, the first corporates found swimming naked often fall under the suspicion of fraud. But they are usually followed by honest players who are facing the same economic and financing pressures. And we do note that, high yield corporates are issuing high yield debt. Defaults in that space have climbed still to quite a low level, but they've climbed to 0.6% in 2025 from around 0.125% in 2022. So, and that's according to the Bank of International Settlements. So we can see that the defaults are rising and spreads have nudged up, high yield spreads have nudged up in the wake of the First Brands Chapter 11 filing to just above 300 basis points from a low of 270 that we saw in September. Now, again, we're not necessarily seeing the canary sort of talons up on its back, having breathed its last, but it's certainly wobbling on the perch there. And the reason for that is not because of the asset class, but because of the corporate stress with regards to the US consumer.
Okay, which leads perfectly on to my next question, which is, what does it tell us about the US consumer and their role within the economy?
Well, I think across the M&A market in 2025, we've seen a kind of bifurcation where there's been a lot of larger deals and big strategic plays and much more difficulty in executing deals, particularly for mid-market private equity houses. I mean, two sponsors that we spoke to for this column, two US-focused sponsors, were saying that what's keeping them up at night is business trading worries, because the US economy seems very split into, on the one hand, consumer-exposed groups, which are reporting customer pain. Then there's a second category of software as a service or SaaS players who are worried about AI eating their lunch. And so there's a degree of concern about, should we be hiring? Can we hire? Where should we be deploying? Buy-siders who might be considering buying those companies are also just wanting to see how the technology falls out before investing further in that industry. And then above all of that, you've got the AI hyperscalers and NVIDIA, who are enjoying a huge investment boom and driving much of US GDP performance. But under the hood of that AI bubble, there's quite a degree of consumer stress. And so, you know, our sister publication, DebtWire, within their stressed universe, of the 50 most recent US entries, 24 have directly consumer-facing operations across food retail, casinos, content broadcasting, to name just a few. And let's not forget that the relentless logic of President Donald Trump's tariffs agenda will only increase pricing pressure and juice inflation over the next 12 to 18 months.
Okay, so there's quite a lot going on, and you mentioned about the credit spreads and the financing conditions and how they're evolving. What does all that mean for M&A?
I mean, essentially, right, so we've got the Federal Reserve and currently engaged in a rate-cutting cycle. It will have escaped no one's notice that the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, is under a considerable amount of pressure from President Trump to cut rates. As a real estate guy, Trump wants lower rates, and he's been putting pressure on the Fed to deliver just that. The Fed is very cautiously embarking on that rate cutting cycle. But if we are seeing corporate stress related to consumer pain creating issues within the credit market, it could be that even as headline interest rates from the Fed come down, the credit spreads widen. So the margin that lenders are looking for increases, which will counteract the effect of any rate cuts. It also has to be said that, as I mentioned, if President, you know, we went, during the COVID crisis, there was quite a degree of government largesse across the world. And it from 2020 through to 2022, it took 12, 18, 24 months for that pricing impact to occur, for inflation to come up to levels that required serious central bank action. If we continue to see price increases as related to President Trump's tariffs agenda over the next 12 to 18 months, not only will we see consumer pressure, which will impact credit spreads and make financing deals much more complicated, but also at the headline level, it will make it that bit more difficult for the Fed to engage further and more aggressively on its rate cutting cycle. So to answer your question about M&A, we could see that the financing conditions become progressively more difficult, which would mean you'd need to have even more conviction on the equity story and the growth profile of the companies that you're buying in order to have conviction that you can take on that financing commitment and invest for a 3 to 5 year period, particularly as a sponsor.
And with all of this going on, it must make the life of a financial journalist and editor a little bit more exciting.
Yeah, we certainly live in interesting times. I've written recently about the AI bubble as well and the valuations there. I think it's fascinating to see the parallels with the dot-com bubble of the late 90s and into 2000. That bubble burst, but it did not mean that the rollout of the internet was a busted flush. We live in an era entirely defined by the internet and the groups that grew around it. What I think is interesting is that the companies that rolled out the infrastructure for the internet revolution, essentially the telcos, were not the key beneficiaries. So, you know, for example, if you look at the Magnificent Seven, Amazon and Alphabet, Google's owner, are in the Magnificent Seven. AT&T and Verizon are not. So I think the winners of the AI revolution are still yet to be crowned, and we don't know necessarily who they will be. This technology is here to last, is here to stay, and it will make an outsized impact on deal flows, the way deals are done, and the selection of targets. But it's not clear who the beneficiaries of that are going to be yet. And so there's a degree of caution out there about how best to lean into what is an overwhelming trend, and also some concern that valuations have run ahead of the, too far ahead of the benefits that are accruing from it. But we have a revolutionary technology and at the same time, a massive shakeup of the geopolitical scene. And I think one thing that's going to really focus minds in the capital markets over the coming months and into the beginning of 2026 is whether the US begins to, whether that consumer pain begins to create the conditions for a recessionary environment. And one indicator I would really ask people to keep an eye on is the Conference Board's expectations index in September. That fell again to 73.4, and is that has been below the level of 80 that typically indicates a recession for 8 months now. So if that indicator continues to weigh, there have to be some concerns about US GDP output in 2026.
So given all of that, and just to finish off, could you outline what deal makers should be keeping an eye on as we head into, dare I say it, 2026?
One of the trends that we've noticed so far already this year is an attempt to engage in right scaling. So if you look at, for example, the Kraft Heinz split, there you've got some, they've obviously faced considerable pricing pressure across their input costs and what they've had to pass on to consumers. But also they've got sort of ready meals on the one hand and condiments and sauces and ketchup and the like on the other. And in both cases, they're relatively squeezed by their positioning within the market. And so they've decided to try to unlock value by splitting that huge enterprise, which was only brought together in sort of recent corporate living memory. And so that's an attempt to try to create leaner and more focused operations by divesting. But equally, you're seeing, huge mergers in order to create scale. So if you look, for example, the huge, I think $88 billion acquisition of Norfolk Southern and Union Pacific Railroads business, obviously that's a big play on infrastructure. It's a big play on scale at a time when that seems a good way to defend yourself against the vicissitudes of the geopolitical scene. So on the one hand, you're seeing companies getting the barnacles off the boat and going leaner and streamlining and focusing on core operations. But where there is conviction about scaling up as a defense against the maelstrom of geopolitical stresses that are out there, that's what they're doing. I mean, I was speaking to a trade expert only last month who was saying that there is something that is quite coercive about the tariffs environment in terms of incentivizing a flight to scale, because it's really only larger corporations that are going to have the wherewithal, the operational muscle to be able to navigate quite complicated trading relationships between different blocks. So if you've got operations in the EU or you're manufacturing in, say, Vietnam, but you want to sell into the US, it's going to be those larger companies that have the operational muscle to manage those trade relationships. And it becomes very, very much more difficult for mom and pop operations or family-owned enterprises to navigate that world. So there is a kind of coercive logic to merging. And I do think that there will be rich pickings, particularly for sponsors in the primary buyout space, where you've got family-owned companies often making very high-quality product, but without the muscle to deliver that into a more fractured geopolitical environment. And scaling up could well be the route to creating value for companies like that.
Great. Lots and lots to think about. John, good to talk to you. Thanks a lot. That was John West, Merger Markets Global Commentary Editor for EMEA and author of the Continental Drift column. And just to point out, we are recording this on Friday, the 25th of October. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Dealcast from Merger Market. I'm Juliana Needham. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please follow it. And if you're on an app that supports it, please give us a rating and review. If you'd like to find out more about what we've been talking about on this episode, have a look at our show notes. See you next time.